Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. It is a real pleasure to be with you today and be joined by someone you've been reading about, and you've read his work and seen the product of what he and his team are doing, which I think is very exciting. But this is going to be your first chance to hear him. So it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Mark Skidmore, who was a professor of state and local government finance and policy at Michigan State University. He has a very distinguished academic career. And I'm thrilled because he and his mighty team have gotten interested in the missing money and are digging in. We have a wonderful commentary up with a report by him on the website. It'll be linked in the commentary to the Soleri Report. And as you can see, we now have up links to all the government documentation for the missing money that Dr. Skidmore and his students have found so far. And if you look at how much they've found, $18 trillion, we're neck and neck with the same number for outstanding debt of the United States. And my prediction is it wouldn't surprise me if Dr. Skidmore and his students surpass the outstanding debt in not too long a time, because I know they may be digging into NASA. We'll see. Anyway, it's a pleasure to welcome him. I'll let him speak for himself. Dr. Skidmore, welcome to the Soleri Report.
Oh, thanks, Catherine. As a quick update, we did find another almost a trillion in DOD that we'll be sending you. And then we also started looking at NASA, and the NASA adjustments are not so huge. They seem within the realm of reasonableness. For unsupported adjustments. We'll talk more about what that is. But so the NASA...
Well, that's good news.
Yeah, the NASA calculations and estimates of undocumented adjustments are much smaller, just a fraction of their full budget. So that feels right. But the DOD one in particular, it's just so large, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit.
Okay, well, before we dive in, tell us a little bit more about you and how it is that you got interested in this issue.
Well, as you mentioned, I hold a chair in state and local government finance and policy, and what that means is that I have a little extra funds to do research and outreach-oriented kinds of activities. So I actually work, or in the past, until my role changed a little bit here at the university, worked a lot with people who are connected to Michigan State University and providing, say, training to new county commissioners on how to read a budget, what are the primary functions of government, what's your role as a county commissioner, and here are some resources. So it's very practical kinds of, I think, helpful things for if you're a newly elected county commissioner, for example. You might be interested in one particular aspect of county government, but now you have to know, well, where do the revenues come from, and what are the full scope of my responsibilities, which are pretty extensive. And so we do that kind of stuff, and then we also do, just good, at least for me, applied research where we use statistical tools to do evaluation. Over the past number of years, I worked a lot on the Detroit crisis and bankruptcy and the collapse of the housing market there as part of the financial crisis. And so that was in part what kind of helped me start thinking about things a little bit differently. So I do a mix of more formal research, some modeling, but more statistical analysis. Do practical kinds of things that hopefully will help communities. That's the kind of stuff that I do. My work in, a couple of things happened to start shifting my frame, and maybe I'll take a few minutes to talk about those things. And, I suppose there were lots of questions that kind of emerged over the years, even beginning 15 years ago when the dot-com bubble was in full bloom. And I remember talking with my students and saying, well, a lot of these companies have these very high valuations, and yet they've never earned a profit, And so how is this possible? And then they talk about the discounted present value of future revenue streams. And so I said, so somebody's really optimistic, right, about these. But I didn't know. I didn't know that the rules had changed and that all this money was flooding, right, into the system. And
right.
So after that crash, we had the housing bubble, and I was looking at this, and this doesn't make sense. I knew people who had very limited income and maybe no job history, no down payment, and yet were getting loans. And my wife and I would just sort of shake our heads, like, what's going on here? And then, of course, the whole thing came tumbling down, and we all remember that. So, in the midst of all of this, I'm looking at Detroit, and, you know, during the housing bubble, there was a lot of subprime credit flowing in to Detroit. And as, you know, sort of with an urban regional economic background, I'm thinking to myself, how can we have rising housing prices in a city that has substantial population decline? We can't tear down houses fast enough. You know, dilapidated houses that just aren't cared for and they're not lived in. And yet housing prices are going up. And it was just, it troubled me. And then when I went on sabbatical, I spent a little time in New Zealand looking at comparing the housing markets here in the United States and policies with New Zealand, because they're concerned about rising housing prices. And New Zealand looks like a small place, but it's actually a very large place. And there's only 4 million people there.
Right.
And so I just, like, what is happening? This is a global thing. While I was on sabbatical, I just said, you know, I have to try to figure out what's going on the economic side, because my traditional models and frameworks for thinking about how the world works, just they weren't helping me. They were misleading, you know. And so that's when I finally had time to look at things more carefully. And I started asking questions like who do our leaders, you know, what interests do our leaders have? Are they thinking of us as they make these policies? What's the power structure? What are the incentives? What's going on? Is my family and my community's well-being central to some of these decisions? Because it didn't, you know. I mean, obviously, we all sort of, whether or not you're really aware or only partially aware, you get the idea that there's a lot of competing forces at play, right? But I just had an opportunity to take time and peek behind the curtain in a world or a venue that I knew very well. I have a PhD in economics, and I didn't understand a lot of things. And after a while, you start looking at, for example, all of the quantitative easing, and this is not just U.S. Essentially money printing, but globally. And I'm just like, wow, we're buying up all kinds of things with printed money. That right now, the Swiss National Bank is buying our IT stock.
Right.
75% of the Japanese ETF funds are owned by the Japanese central bank.
Right.
Now we've kind of laid off, but the ECB is buying corporate bonds and sovereign bonds, and we're suppressing interest rates right now. $15 trillion globally is in the negative interest rate territory. And there isn't a real frank without suppression, that really I don't think can happen. And
right.
So there's massive interventions. And as I looked at all of this, I thought, well, you know, I think I'm going to, you know, diversify my portfolio. And so I invested some in gold and silver. And then I started watching those markets, and you think, wow, I think there's plenty of evidence available to show that those markets are also suppressed. So you have lots of suppression happening everywhere, and not necessarily free market activity, And so my framework started to really evolve and realize that, wow, we don't really have free markets at all. And increasingly so, we have just massive interventions. And this is, you know, from my point of view, not a sustainable path. And when you hold things back or you try to force things for long, you run the risk of creating big distortions and potential, you know, shocks down the road. So this worried me, and I can remember looking at things going from, geez, this doesn't look good, and then you dig a little deeper, and wow, this is really bad. And you go a layer deeper, and you think, wow, this is dangerous, because not only is there suppression, there's apparently illegal, you know, activity at some scale, a lack of rule of law, and, you know, so then you start looking behind a piece that you know, and you see all this stuff, and that gives you an opportunity to say, well, I wonder what else is going on. And right. So then you start looking at geopolitics, and I think the thing that really, really got me, and for your, the folks who listen to your reports and read your stuff, this is not a surprise to them, but, you know, up until a couple years ago, I just didn't fully understand what happened at 9/11. And right. When I started looking at that, and, you know, and there's plenty of evidence out there to suggest that the official reports just don't fly at all. They're far from what's true, and it's hard to know exactly for sure what happened, but you can certainly refute the official reports. And I remember just watching, you could look at the two towers that fell, but the third building, 7, watching that fall in just an absolute free fall, and just watching it over and over again, I didn't need an engineer to tell me that that wasn't the result of fire. That was that was something other than fire. How could that have happened? And so, you know, if you come to terms with that, then you have to conclude that the media is complicit, our government leaders are complicit, our core business leaders are complicit in sort of mopping all of this over for some reason. And now you realize, oh, I see what's going on. and that caused a real shift for me. And, of course, I've now thinking about it more, that wasn't the only event. And, you know, I'm reading The Devil's Chessboard, something you recommend right now, and we can see that these kinds of things have happened for a long time.
Right. It's been evolving for a long time.
So that is sort of my background, where I am now. I've decided I needed to go back to school, and I've been several years just digging into information and doing my best to sort through and make sense of the world and create a new frame for me to think about things. And I think that's all good, and I think I'll be doing that for the rest of my life.
Well, it's interesting, because if you look at real change, what's essential is that you change how time and money works at the local governmental and state governmental level. So in other words, the rubber really meets the road when you switch how things are working at the local level. So you're right at the heart of where the change has to happen.
And that was part of my motivation for looking at state and local government and regional economics. There's a lot of stuff that happens at the local level that is within our purview and control that we can do something about. And there are a lot of experiments. We still have a lot of autonomy at the local level for experimenting, and so we can learn about what works and what doesn't. And that's really been a mainstay of my research is, how do we play out what works and what doesn't?
Did you by any chance read the Lafayette, Louisiana study that Chuck Marone and the Strongtown team did?
Well, you know, actually, I just invited him to give a talk for our little podcast at the Rural Development Center that I direct.
Oh, wonderful.
I'd listened to that and just talking about the, for every dollar of private infrastructure above ground, there's $2 underground, and how this is really not sustainable, especially right. in places where population is flat or declining.
Right.
And so it's a real challenge. You know, we've, in many cases, we've overbuilt.
Right.
And we have to figure out how to do this smarter.
Yeah, so I think, you know, if we can get the federal money turned around, you know, you're still going to have to turn around what's going on at state and local, because that's where, you know, that's where you have to perform to a positive return on investment to the governmental money. And it's got to be federal, state, and local. And what I saw when I worked in the first Bush administration is the federal investment is making the world much tougher and more expensive for the state and local governments.
Yeah, but there's always this incentive at the local level to take those federal dollars because you kind of need
right.
them and you're worried about your tax base, and yet you're, you know, you could potentially be saddled for more infrastructure than you really, really need.
Right.
And then you have all of these asymmetries of negotiating power, you know, with these larger retail and other kinds of establishments looking for, to locate in places where they have the largest tax breaks. And so now you're thinking about, well, I've got to put in all this infrastructure. And sure, the retail expands a bit, and this is good for the community. We create some jobs. But what about the long run when
right.
this entity shuts down
right.
and moves on? You know, how are we going to pay for all this? So
right.
those are real challenges. And some places are seem to be doing it pretty well, and other places are struggling.
Okay, so let's turn to the missing money. There's, you've now counted, we have posted $18 trillion of what's called undocumentable adjustments in the DOD and HUD accounts. It sounds like you found another trillion, so it's up to $19 trillion. What is an undocumentable adjustment, and what does this mean, $18 trillion of undocumentable adjustments at HUD and DOD?
Well, let's talk about the definition and then what it might mean. I think what I would like to emphasize is that, you know, from my perspective and pulling up public documents, I can't know for sure what all of this means, but I still, whether or not I know what it is, for reasons we'll discuss, I think we all have an interest in full disclosure and transparency because it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So let's start with the formal definition. I'm just going to read it. This is from a federal government document. Journal vouchers are summary-level accounting adjustments made when balances between systems cannot be reconciled. Often these journal vouchers are unsupported, and that's what we're talking about, unsupported journal voucher adjustments, meaning they lack supporting documentation to justify the adjustment or are not tied to specific accounting transactions. While many of these transactions are valid, having too many journal vouchers may be an indicator of underlying problems such as weak internal controls. For an auditor, journal vouchers are a red flag for transactions not being captured, reported, or summarized correctly. So basically, these are adjustments that are made to the budget when an auditor doesn't really know what a transaction is. And these transactions can be, you know, if I can think back, you know, to something a little simpler like a local government budget, there might be some adjustments, but they're very small and they're never larger than the entire budget of a city or a school.
Right.
district. They're just minor adjustments typically because there was a missing receipt or a transaction that, you know, it wasn't clear what that was used for. And that stuff happens all the time. But in the case of the 2016 report for the Army that you had referred to, in an interview, and this is what got me interested in this whole issue, is you said in this interview that the Army had unsupported journal voucher adjustments of $6.5 trillion. Now, the entire DoD budget is just $500 to $600 billion.
Right. So it's 10 times.
We're 10 times, yeah. And
right.
I just thought, that does not sound right. I actually thought you were wrong, Catherine. I thought she must be making a mistake. And so I looked at it myself, and sure enough, it was there. And I thought, how can this be? And there are, you know, there's lots of little explanations about missing records and no documentation or systems that don't within DoD that don't talk to each other, but really no clear explanation about what's going on. And, so this troubled me, and I decided to send you an email, and within, I think, 10 minutes of me sending that email, you called me. Because I was going to ask you if it would help if we spent a little time digging through the government websites to try to find other documents that indicated the magnitudes of these adjustments. And so you called me and said, yeah, it'd be great. It'd be a great service. So, what we did wasn't, rocket science. We just spent a little time searching through the government's own documents, trying to find what the size and magnitude of these adjustments are, going all the way back to 1998. And what we found so far is far from complete, but we're approaching $19 trillion of adjustments. And for context, if you were to add up all of the appropriated spending for DoD from 1998 to 2002, you would get about $8.5 trillion, which is a substantial investment in defense. But the adjustments were more than double that. And
right.
So how can that, and so that's what troubles me. And I don't have an answer. I think, Catherine, with your experiences and context and your time at HUD, the experiences you had, you have some context here. But from my perspective as somebody sitting in the office here in the Midwest, it doesn't pass muster, right? I mean, I was trying to think of a way to have it, kind of put it in context. And $19 trillion is about $160,000 per household in adjustments, things that we just don't really can't account for. Some of us have been to school board meetings or a county commissioner meeting, and we kind of know how that works and how we talk about budgets. Maybe more of us have been in a church meeting where we have somebody who handles the bookkeeping for a church. And so suppose you're a small to medium-sized church with a $500,000 budget, and you have revenues coming in, and typically there's always two people who, track the money coming in. There's never one person that you rely on solely, and everybody's happy to do that, because you want to be transparent and honest about it. And then you have a bookkeeper who kind of tracks things, and in your church meeting when you're approving a budget, I can just sort of imagine your accounting person. Our accounting person is somebody who's retired, has a degree from University of Chicago. She's just really good, and I can just imagine her trying to explain what we're doing with the money over the past year and how we spent it. And then she says, "Oh, and by the way, we have a little bit of an adjustment we had to make." And so in addition to the $500,000 that came in through our normal processes, we spent $5 million, but we really don't know where it went. Well, we had some, it might be $2.5 million coming in and $2.5 million going out. The adjustments don't always, say, you know, in the reports, you know, whether it was money flowing in or out or across departments or what. But, you know, if you were in that meeting, you would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. We, you know, I trust my pastor, but I think we got to look under the hood here and find out what's going on, because that's in your purview and you're used to that. And
one of the first things that really just sent me into the, you know, so the thing saying big red flag was when it was my attorney who first found the report from HUD that $59 billion had been missing the year before, and I think $17 trillion the year before that. And I'm sorry, it was $59 billion and then $17 billion missing. And in the report, the inspector general said that they couldn't reconcile what had happened and where this, you know, they couldn't balance the books. They couldn't figure out what happened, but they were going to make sure it wouldn't happen again. So I thought, why would you, so back to the church, if your CPA said, look, you know, we have these $5 million of undocumented adjustments, but we've done this and this to the systems and it won't happen again, I dare say you would not be satisfied and say, oh, well, then it's okay. You'd say, no, wait, I want to know.
You'd want to know what happened. Where did the money come from and where did it go?
Right.
And if somebody, you know, your elder board said, well, you know, don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. You know, it's all good. We'll get the system fixed. You know, even if you weren't sort of, my frame has changed, as a lot of your listeners have as well, and so we're, you know, skeptical. But even if you weren't skeptical and you looked at this report, you would say, boy, this doesn't make any sense. We should really look at it. We should go in and dig in and find out what those we can find out what those transactions were. And what's interesting in that 2016 report where we have the $6.5 trillion for fiscal year 2015, they do have some information. You know, for example, they have almost $1 trillion flowing into the Army from Treasury. So a part of the unsupported journal voucher adjustment is about $800 billion flowing in. And then about $900 billion flowing out through accounts payable to somebody, and apparently nobody knows where that money came from or where the money went. And remember, the entire DOD budget is only about $500-600 billion, and the Army is just a fraction of that total. So, I don't fully understand, even if it were to reconcile previous budget activity to kind of get things up to speed, when you have it over and over again, it, even if you're not skeptical, you would say, wow, we better, you know, you can't even do good cost-benefit analysis if you have no idea what's happening with spending in the budget.
Right, I mean, that's how can the thing. You can't evaluate performance or assess performance or change policies. I'll never forget when I first got to HUD. There were no financial statements, and finally I got the accounts. I lobbied the White House, got the accounts moved over to report to me, and asked them to do cash flow estimations of where we were making and losing money. So I called. It turns out we had lost $1 billion the year before in Region 6, which was Texas and included Arkansas. It was during Iran-Contra. And I called the regional. We had a regional administrator and a deputy regional administrator who were arguably some of our finest management. They were very competent, very good, very capable, and very caring. And I called them and I said, how much money do you think you lost last year? And they said, oh, we think we broke even. I said, no, you lost $1 billion. You know, I'm going to fax you the financial statements. Well, I flew down the next day, and it was interesting. They'd gone off into a smoke-filled room in a restaurant off campus and literally put together the 10 steps they needed to take to stop all the monkey business. And, you know, I didn't need to do a thing. They knew exactly what to do as long as they had the transparency. And you'll see, Yeah, you'll see the same thing with communities when they get transparency about the housing, the real housing money and credit in their place. So, you know, people need a map if they're going to, I mean, it's like driving to California with a map that's wrong. You know, you're going to end up in Mexico. You're not going to end up in the right place. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the excuses before we go on to the history. One of the excuses you always hear is, well, the systems don't talk to each other. The reality is, if you look at what it does to, you know, if you take an operation that has many different subsidiary operations, all you have to do is reconcile each one. If you look at the money involved, it certainly is worth paying the people to sit around and do it. If you look at the amount of money that the Department of Defense spends on both civil service and on contractors, and you look at the very high competency of the both the civil service and the contractors that they pay, I mean, these are people who run very sophisticated operations and their systems work in their companies. And then the civil service is perfectly competent to run, you know, anything that is required for the Department of Defense. So you have, whether it's contractors or civil service, you know, the excuse that somehow incompetency, it's too complicated, it's too, they're incompetent, they can't do it, it's too big, it's too much stuff. You know, it's just, it doesn't, if you've ever been associated with any of those bureaucracies, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't hold water.
You know, part of the funding for the center that I operate comes from the USDA, and so I have regular interactions with really good people there.
Right.
And they work really hard, extremely competent. And, you know, the last thing I want to say is that you know, our defense people are incompetent. You know, I have close friends who have been and are in the military. I once taught at the Air Force Academy, and you know,
right.
So it, you know, I think we need to make a distinction between, you know, competence within the system and something happening maybe at a higher level that is leading to this. And I, you know, and again, I can't know for sure what's going on with my context, but I'm willing to ask the question, like, what is happening, and why don't our legislators inquire and open up the books, look under the hood, and see where these transactions are really flowing to and from?
Right, and here's the reality. The appropriation clause says you can't spend money that isn't envisioned in an appropriation, and Congress has the ability to shut off the spigot. In other words, Congress doesn't have to keep appropriating. They can say, look, until you produce audited financial statements as required by law and as required by the Constitution and prove that your spending is, you know, as envisioned in appropriation, we're going to turn off the spigot. They have the power to do that. But they haven't.
Yeah.
Right.
They could use that power. It might, maybe there are some barriers there to prevent that from happening.
Well, one of the magical moments on email, you know, I always have these magical moments on email. I got an email from you, and I forget exactly what it was, but you had finally realized, okay, the New York Fed member banks are the depository for the U.S. government. So whatever transactions are happening, they have a record. Most of them are going through them, you know, so they're depository for the Treasury and for the agencies, you know, so there is a complete record at the banks of all transactions made. So if you want to look at this on a cash basis and including the credit that they service, you know, you can see, if not everything, you can see an awful lot. And so there was this kind of magical moment when you realized, wait a minute, you know.
It was another moment. It was sort of the 9/11 moment. Oh, all these organizations are complicit in this, you know, some way, somehow. Oh, the Fed knows.
Yeah, of course.
Or they could know if they wanted to. You know.
Yeah. So, and before we go on, I just wanted to mention how much is $19 trillion at the when the housing bubble burst and we had the bailouts. I think $8 trillion would have paid off all the single mortgages in the country. So $18 trillion is a great deal of money. And if you look at all the issues we're talking about, whether it's tax reform or health care, et cetera, you know, it's certainly enough money to fund all these things we say we can't afford.
Yeah, it's still a lot of money, but, you know, I think when we talk about adjustments in excess of the appropriated amounts, we have to be talking about adjustments of revenues flowing in from somewhere and flowing out to somewhere. So, right now we have $18 or $19 trillion of adjustments, but we don't know how much of that is flowing in and how much is flowing out. So if you were to take a guess, you could say $9 or $10 trillion flowing in and $9 or $10 trillion flowing out. That's based on what we know so far, which is only partial of, you know, of all the years that for which we could collect if we had that information.
Right. So from a cash standpoint, this could be, the real money could be much lower or much more. There's no way to know.
Yeah, and, you know, if you read some of these reports, it'll say, well, we've got these multiple things happening from one system to the next, and their money's moving back and forth, so you're double, triple counting transactions.
Right.
Again, it doesn't fully make sense to me, because you would know that. You would know that there was this transfer, and it wouldn't be unsupported. You could explain it. So all this is to say it's you know, just looking at the reports, it's mysterious.
Well, I wanted to touch base and quickly give a little bit of a history, just so that the folks who are listening to this who haven't heard a lot about the missing money have it. This started, you know, so I've been kind of trying to keep the question alive for since 1997. I became embroiled it started for me in 1997. I was meeting with a group of pension fund leaders who were on one of my boards for my subsidiary. And I had presented to them a presentation of how we could re-engineer government investment in communities to basically significantly improve the performance of federal spending and investment in places. And I was using Philadelphia as an example, and I was down at Safeguard Scientifics outside of Pennsylvania. It's a big investor. And so we're sitting there, and the president of CalPERS is on the board, and he looks at me and he says, "You don't understand. It's too late. They've given up on the country. They're going to move all the money out starting at the fall. And you've got to get to," he said, "Nick Brady," who'd been the Secretary of Treasury, "and tell him it's not hopeless and, you know, things can really be fixed." So I thought he meant that the pension funds were planning on shifting their allocations so that they were going to shift allocations into the emerging markets and other things. It never occurred to me that they might be emptying out the coffers of the government assets. So that fall, money started to go missing, and I didn't realize it was going missing from the federal government. What I started to see were some of the big investors were suddenly magically raising huge amounts of money with no problem to do investments in China and the emerging markets, and it was kind of like suddenly they were exploding with billions of dollars in investment. You think, where is this coming from? It was during the impeachment. And no one was interested. You know, everybody was talking about Monica Lewinsky's dress, and I kept trying to interest people. Wait a minute. There's something really strange happening. Just all these guys are getting billions of dollars, and they're making all these investments. What's going on? You know, but everybody's talking about Monica Lewinsky. Well, then my attorney was reading an IG report that was on the, I think it was the 97 or the 98 year, and it was testimony they had given and announced that they couldn't. It was another testimony in why they couldn't complete audited financial statements. The first Bush administration had gotten laws passed requiring audited financial statements, and I'd been part of writing that law for HUD, and that was the one that had triggered the law that was then taken government-wide. And so the IG was basically saying there's $59 billion missing this year. There was $17 billion missing in the opening accounts, And we have thrown up our hands in disgust, but we promise it won't happen next year. And, you know, we almost fell off our chair, Mark. And what was amazing then, I started to send it around and pass it around to people. And, of course, if you look at the mortgage fraud and predatory loans that were going on, you know, there it was perfectly reasonable that they would be financing it with mortgage fraud because the mortgage fraud was exploding. And it was an astonishing experience to me because no one would pay any attention to it. One, they would say, oh, well, I'm sure there's no problem and, you know, go away. Or, you know, as you thought, you're not making any sense. I'm sure this is not happening. You must have it wrong. And it went on like this for a while. And then I was on KPFA Radio, which is a little community radio station out in Berkeley, quite good. And Cynthia McKinney followed me with the same host and confirmed that what I was saying was true, that there was billions of dollars missing and something was going on. And she was a sitting congresswoman at the time, and her willingness to confirm it made it credible. And then we got the Insight magazine to do the series. Then 9/11 happened, and many of the things that happened in 9/11 were critical in sort of covering up. You know, sometimes I think it was a missing money knowledge management operation. Jim Corbett has a great video, if anybody's interested, called 9/11 and I think it's 9/11 and the missing money or the missing trillions. And then it's very good. And then Senator Thompson did a report in Government Affairs, which I've sent you, talking about the inability of the federal government to comply with the financial management laws, number one, producing audited financial statements, which to this day the federal government never has, and a primary reason was DOD. And 9/11 was used as an excuse on many of that. So then we hit the financial crisis and the bailouts, and literally between 9/11 and the financial crisis, it's been very difficult to interest people in the topic. And then, of course, in 2015, the stunning $6.5 trillion just seemed to be so big and so ridiculous that I think people are now finally beginning to realize, wait a minute, if you have a federal financial mechanism that has no transparency, no accountability, then the real control and governance of the government can be run by the people who control that. In other words, this is a real governance, a fundamental governance issue, you know, because as long as you want to do whatever you want, you can do it as long as you can finance it.
I would agree with you. If you don't have a level of transparency, how can you verify what's happening? And, right. You know, I understand that there probably are some programs that at some level you would have to conceal, but I don't think what we're seeing here is that. I can't make any sense of it. I actually have a call in to the primary contact for this 2016 report. I was hoping she would call me back before this interview, so I could have some context from her perspective, you know. And in some sense, you know, the IGO office they're reporting on this. So right. In some sense, they're doing their job. And right. If our legislators don't follow up, they're missing their role, right? And so if we don't have at an agency level, something happening in terms of transparency and checks and balances, and we don't have our legislators, our elected officials doing anything in a representative democracy, it falls on us. Right. And I think that's part why I thought, well, you know, I can do at least one thing, and that is reduce the costs of people digging in and finding all this stuff. All they have to do now is go to your website, and you can click on all the reports, and we've identified the page number, and you can look yourself, you can read the reports and see if they make sense to you. We have plenty of highly capable, intelligent people that I think if you read these reports, you would say, you know, this doesn't really make a lot of sense. We need to look at this.
Well, the other thing you can do is whenever you meet with your state or federal officials, you can bring this up. It was interesting. One of the Tennessee congressmen was running for governor. I went to a town hall meeting at a local bank, and there were about 30 or 40 of my neighbors. And I said to him, at the time there was $3.3 trillion missing. I said, there's $3.3 trillion missing from the federal government. And he said in front of everyone, yes, I know. And the local banker almost fell off his chair. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? Because he was on both defense appropriations and the budget committee. And he looked at me and said, nothing. There's nothing I can do. But I think if many, many citizens started bringing it up, and because if you look at all the different budget discussions we're having, particularly about retirement savings or Social Security, to me, whatever amount $19 trillion translates into, that's real money. And somehow we have to find a way within the budget to make everything real and bring it down to real money, and then start to shift it into a framework that can support real performance.
You know, and you said this before in other interviews and discussions that, you know, the question, could we possibly get this money back if we could follow the paper trail? And I don't have the answer to that question because I don't know where the money went. But that seems like a discussion that's on the table as well. If this was not authorized and lots of money flowed to places or into investments that are still, you know, in ownership, it might be possible, you know, to get
It is possible, because believe it or not, I litigated for many years with the Department of Justice over something called common law right of offset. And the federal government has taken the position that if you've done something as a contractor inappropriate, if you've made an illegal transaction, if you've done something that lost the government money, they can assert a common law right of offset and demand ownership of your assets or payment for whatever that was. So wherever this money went, it created an asset, or it's associated with an entity that has assets, and you can assert a common law right of offset. Not only can you get those assets, but then you can say, well, you know, every household owes, you know, the big banks $160,000. Well, we'll just assert a common law right of offset and tear up that $166,000. You know, on our credit card or on our whatever. So, you know, it sounds a little cute, but there are absolutely ways of holding the process accountable and asserting rights to those assets. Because if you're, you know, you have a lot of people running around this country promoting the idea that we should balance the budget. If we balance the budget with our assets, you know, on the table, and that $19 trillion not on the table, it's a very different picture than if it is on the table.
It's hard for me to imagine how that would actually happen. But if enough of us say, you know, these don't pass the smell test, and we really need to look underneath the hood here and find out what is the nature of these transactions over the past 20 years.
Right.
And then we can say, well, okay, what can we do about this? If we don't do that, you know, it really falls on us.
Well, here's what I hear, and when I watch the politics around the budget, what I hear is the American people are wasteful. The American people have misused their time and money. The American people are dependent on too many entitlements from government, and the American people need to cut back. So there's a spin going on. And I think by putting this $19 trillion back on the table, at a minimum, you shift the spin. Because you say, okay, you know, it's true, we drink too much carbonated drinks, you know, or we eat too much sugar. So, you know, we can confess to our sins, but we need all the money on the table, and we need to look about, you know, where the money has really gone and how we got to where we are. So to me, I think the politics of transforming the budget are going to be very, very different. The other thing is, I think the thing that's got the budget negotiation stuck is there's so much going on that you can't be honest about. You know, and I don't just mean about illegal things, just, you know, political things. You know, we've reached the point where the absence of the ability to go into the invention room and have an honest conversation about real needs has reached a point where it's so dysfunctional and we have to do it. So anything that brings transparency to how the money really has worked, how it works now, and what we need going forward, to me, is essential. I come back to the fact that a lot of the policies of what's going on in Washington are basically dedicated to creating global domination in a way which is against the wishes of the American people, but they can continue to do it as long as they can finance it.
You know, and it's interesting, you know, as a state and local public finance economist, one of the benefits of a decentralized structure is that you end up with, you know, different places meeting the needs of their people, because each place is different and they know what is needed. And so this whole centralization thing, I agree with you, there is this globalization and centralization, and there's tremendous pushback because people say, well, this doesn't meet our need. And
right.
And that's one of the nice things about, you know, looking at communities, because you have lots of places doing different things to meet the needs of people, and it's not perfect, and there are experiments. But, you know, I think about the Brexit in the EU, and, you know, right now the way the EU is structured, as I understand it, there's no mechanism or voice for people to express their concerns or vote on the leadership of the EU. And so, you know, in my mind, the Brexit response was people just being mad. It's like, well, I can't do anything. I don't have any option. And so my response to the EU is, if you want people to buy in, you have to give them a voice, and you have to you have to be flexible. But I don't think that's sort of what the goal of the EU is.
If you look at that chart I sent you from Fortune magazine that shows the revenues of the Fortune 500 growing by more than double the GNP of the country since 1995. So they tracked from 55 to 95, they tracked approximately the same. So the Fortune 500 revenues went up about the amount that the GNP ran off. And then you hit 95, you pull the tech companies into the Dow index, and then you do globalization. And suddenly you're centralizing everything into publicly traded stocks. And we're watching a political mechanism that's under constant pressure to feed that, you know, feed running the economy through that. And unfortunately, what I saw at HUD was constantly making policy decisions that would lift up stocks of a variety of different companies, but didn't make economic sense on the ground. And so you had this corporate tornado hitting a local community, and you were generating lots of fees for our friends, and it was lifting the corporate stock, but you weren't getting a serious improvement with the economy that was sustainable. So you're using government to facilitate a win-lose relationship between, you know, large corporations or publicly traded companies and the local economy. And to me, you've got to get that back in balance. You've got to create a win-win relationship. So, because the more it's win-lose, the more the politics get ugly. And ultimately, the Dow can't keep going up if we're having a civil war. So it seems to me better to get this back into a kind of positive alignment. And so the question starts with whether it's the federal money, state and local money, how do you get that money re-engineered into a positive return on investment or get it optimized? It's going to take involvement of the citizens to do that. They're going to have to want to have this happen.
Yeah. They're going to, I think we all have to feel a stake in it.
Right.
You know, just coming back to these unsupported adjustments or undocumented adjustments, it, you know, in a sense, we have to be willing to step out and ask these questions and bring transparency and checks and balances to the system. And it could be that, you know, there are good reasons for what's going on, but somehow if it's cloaked, you know, I have my doubts. And, we've got to take a look at it. And if enough of us ask questions and share information, maybe we can make some headway there.
Well, I, for one, so appreciate what you and your students are doing, because it's made an enormous difference, I think, to a lot of the people, you know, that come to our website who are interested in this, just to have direct access to all the government documents and to have someone of your position and caliber reviewing it, looking at it, checking it, describing it. So it's been very energizing for all of us, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Well, thanks. We just, it's just a little bit of, hard work to go in and dig in, and it's sort of economies of, if we can sort of centralize that effort a little bit and make it a little easier for people, then we feel like we're helping a bit. But I wouldn't have thought to look at this if I hadn't heard you talk about it, and I know that you've been asking these questions for a very long time. So
people have been thinking I'm wrong for 20 years. It's
well,
kind of funny.
I understand why people doubt this.
Uh-huh. I do too. Yeah.
Some people refer to The Matrix, or John Rappaport's work. I really have appreciated him actually helped me come out of my tailspin a little bit as I thought about all these issues. Where was I? I'm just sort of, if you question things, it's not too far-fetched to say, wow, this is not right. But if you have an underlying faith in the structure and the system, it's really easy to say, well, they've got a handle on it. As part of the report in 16, where the federal government is supposed to be audit ready by the end of this month, and so a recent article came out questioning whether the DOD will be audit ready. And so there's always the swirl and, well, yeah, they're working on it. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens after then this next fiscal year, if we do any better within government.
Well, but to me, even if we're audit ready, I want to know how much has disappeared and how we get it back. Because just because we stop stealing doesn't mean it's okay to keep what you stole. So
I agree. We can't just give up on what has happened in the past, and I guess that's one of the reasons why I thought this would be a useful thing to do, because whether or not you are skeptical or doubtful, you can look at this and say, even if there isn't any ill intent, and we still can't conduct effective cost-benefit analysis. We have no idea how these funds are being used and whether we can evaluate what's good and what's bad within DOD or for that matter, HUD. So even if you're not skeptical, you can still take this and say, yeah, we really need to actually look under the hood to find out why we have all of these unsupported adjustments and where did it go?
Right, so I'm going to be a tough guy now and differentiate between DOD and HUD. If you look at pretty reliable polls, the military is the most admired institution in America. They still hold 50% or better respect by the population, whereas most Washington institutions don't. I think Congress is now at 16% and has been as low as 10%. But HUD is a different story. I know HUD well, having gone in 89, brought in an auditor, brought in computers, brought in systems. There was absolutely no reason for HUD not to produce audited financial statements as required by law all along the way. The undocumentable adjustments were easily figured out and found. And there's absolutely no excuse. And if you look at all the other sort of experiences and stories and phenomena, you know, including the housing bubble, I assure you massive fraud was going on at HUD. So I differentiate between the two. And one of my confident, you know, the reason I'm so confident is I saw the collusion of the New York Fed member banks and the Treasury and, you know, all sorts of different government agencies. You know my story of visiting the chief of staff to the Senate Appropriations chair, and I was trying to get my company paid. HUD owed me money. And the chief of staff said, "What do you think is going on at HUD?" And I was trying to be discreet. I said, "I don't know. What do you think is going on at HUD?" And they said, "HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise." Well, and I said, I don't disagree. So, you know, I can't speak for DOD because I just don't have enough personal knowledge, but I can speak for HUD. And as far as I'm concerned, the undocumentable adjustments at HUD represent the tip of the iceberg of serious illegality and fraud. So,
and I would. And Catherine, I think you know from our discussions and email that I too am not, you know, I'm skeptical.
Right.
And, you know, but I'm trying to think about it as a way of bringing people together, because it's oftentimes hard to have conversations about, you know, this kind of level of corruption or downright evil when you think about what happened at 9/11 or other kinds of things.
Right.
So,
well, I agree completely with your approach. Let's just work from the documented facts. Let's just ask questions and work from the documented facts.
Whether you think there's a darkness happening here, or in deep corruption, or, you know, just bad systems, this is really bad for the country not to know what's going on. And there's a way to find out.
Right. Right. Well, I, for one, am thrilled that you're helping. So we're in cahoots. I'm going to encourage everybody listening, if they have any questions, please send them for Dr. Skidmore. I'll batch them and forward them, and maybe we'll get them answered, because I know this conversation has just begun. You keep finding trillions more, a trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon you're talking about a lot of money.
Well, we'll just keep plugging away at it. I think at this point, when you're up to 18 or 20 trillion, the point has been made.
Yes.
You know, we'll keep looking at it. And, you know, it was actually encouraging to see that NASA didn't have these same kinds of adjustments, you know, going on. They were more within the normal range for what you would think of as an unsupported journal voucher adjustment.
I'm surprised, because at one point we found it was about 2,000. We found a 500, a big one, a 500 billion undocumentable adjustment. I'll go back and see if I can find my notes.
For NASA? Yeah, please let me know, and maybe that will give us a hint to, maybe we're looking in the wrong place.
It could have, you know, it could have gotten reconciled. So I don't know. I'll see if I can find it.
Well, okay. And, you know, the other thing that maybe I'll say before we close is, you know, I sort of wondered, and I hope to talk with the person who developed the 2016 report soon here, but, you know, it is interesting that we have these reports that show us how big the adjustments are.
Right.
So I think that's kind of interesting, and I'm not sure what to make of it, because if you wanted to hide it, it seems like it might be possible to do that. But on the other hand, maybe the mechanisms are in place, that, you know, there's still an accountability mechanism there that helps us see what's happening. And so that's encouraging, too.
Right. Well, I'm hoping you still have plenty of good people in the civil service. And you certainly put into place good financial management laws. And if you have good people left in the civil service, then there's definitely something to work with. Okay, well, Dr. Mark Skidmore, thank you again. You have a wonderful afternoon.
Thanks, Catherine. Talk to you soon.